Chapter 29. Webb drove down the street to his mother's home. He still didn't know what the hell to do with it. To sell it would require him to fix it up, and he would have to do that himself, since his bank account wouldn't allow the convenience of hiring professionals to do it. And yet he had no desire to tighten one hinge or replace one shingle on the place. Webb was here because it had occurred to him that if he was going to be staying out at the farm for a while, he would need some clothes. He didn't want to go back to his own home right now. The reporters were probably still staking it out. However, he kept some clothes at his mom's house, too. He also wanted to return the box containing much of Harry Sullivan's life to the attic. Being constantly on the move now, Webb didn't want a chance losing it. He also wasn't sure what to do about his father. Should he call the main prison? Was that the place to get reacquainted with his old man? Yet chances were, at his age, Harry Sullivan was going to die in prison. This might be Webb's only shot. It was funny how almost being blown to bits by a bomb in a phone made you reorder your priorities. His musings about his father stopped when his phone rang. It was Claire, and she sounded nervous, yet determined.
"I've been giving our sessions a lot of thought, Webb. I think we need to change tactics somewhat. I'm curious about a few things, and I think they can be better addressed in a different sort of way."
"Well, that's incredibly vague, Claire. What exactly are you talking about?"
"From our discussion so far, Webb, it seems to me that many of your issues stem from your relationship with your mother and stepfather. During our last session, you told me that you had grown up in your mother's house and that you had recently inherited it from her."
"So?"
"And you also mentioned that you would never consider living there. Also, that your stepfather died there."
"Again, so what?"
"I think there might be something else there. You remember I said I listened for cues from my patients? Well, I'm getting a big one from you here."
"What does an old house have to do with my issues?"
"It's not the house, Webb. It's what might have happened in the house," he persisted.
"What might have happened in the house, other than my stepfather kicking the bucket, that has anything to do with me?"
"Only you know that."
"And I'm telling you, that's all I know. And I really don't see how my freezing in an alley has anything to do with my growing up in that house. That was a long time ago."
"You'd be amazed, Webb, at how long the mind can keep something under wraps until it erupts one day. Your encounter with the little boy in the alley could have triggered something from your past."
"Well, I'm telling you, I don't know what that is."
"If I'm right, you do know, Webb, only your conscious mind doesn't realize it."
He rolled his eyes. "What kind of psychobabble crap is that?" In response, Claire said,
"Webb, I'd like to hypnotize you."
He was stunned. "No."
"It really could help us get somewhere."
"How can making me bark like a dog while I'm unconscious help?"
"Being in a hypnotic state is a form of enhanced consciousness, Webb. You'll be aware of everything going on around you. You will be in complete control. I can't make you do anything you don't want to."
"It won't help."
"You can't know that. It can allow you to address some issues you ordinarily would be inhibited from doing."
"There are some things in my head maybe I don't want to figure out."
"You never know, Webb, until you try. Please think about it. Please."
"Look, Claire, I'm sure you've got lots of crazy people to help. Why don't you think about them for a while?" He clicked off.
Webb pulled his car into the driveway, went inside, packed a duffel of clothes, and then hesitated at the bottom of the attic stairs, holding the Harry Sullivan box under one arm.
"This really shouldn't be so hard," he told himself. An attic was an attic. Though he had told Claire otherwise, there was something about this house that had rattled him somewhere deep in his soul. Yet he reached up, gripped the cord, and pulled down the stairs.
When he got to the attic, he put the box down and reached for the light cord, but then drew his hand back. He looked to the various corners, seeking out threats, an endeavor that was now more instinct than habit. He drew his gaze across the plywood floor and then to all the blackened shapes of his family's bleak history, in the form of clothes racks, piles of books, heaps of junk left to rot. The stack of burgundy-colored rug remnants near the stairway held his attention. They were tightly rolled and bound with tape. He picked one up. It was heavy and very hard, stiff as it was with both cold and age. The remnants matched the rug on the floor below, and Webb wondered why his mother had kept them. Off to the side, there once had been a large pile of clothes. Now the space was empty. Webb had sometimes come up here, pulled the attic door closed after him, and hidden under the clothes pile during his stepfather's many rampages. His stepfather had also kept his stash of drugs and special liquor up here, too, because he feared his wife getting her hands on them. He would stumble up here in the middle of the night, already wasted, and seek out additional means to do his mind further damage. It was the early 70s, the country still digging itself out from Vietnam, and people like his stepfather, who had never taken up arms for his country or for any other cause, used the general angst and indifference of the times as an excuse to live life on a perpetual high. Part of the attic floor was also over the ceiling of Webb's bedroom. When he was young and in bed, Webb would hear his stepfather's footsteps overhead as the man sought out his mood-altering substances. Young Webb would be terrified that Stockton might come crashing down through the ceiling to land on top of him and beat the hell out of him. A cobra in your bed, kill or be killed. When Stockton did beat him, Webb would have gone to his mother, but most of the time she was not there to console him. She often took long drives at night and came home in the morning, hours after Webb had dressed and fed himself and rushed off to school so he wouldn't have to confront the old man across the breakfast table. The creak of steps still bothered him to this day. He closed his eyes and breathed in the chilly air, and in his mind that old vanished pile of clothes rose high into the air. And then right on cue there was a slash of red, and then sounds flooded him that made Webb open his eyes and rush back down the stairs and close the attic door. He had had this vision 1,000 times and could never figure it out. He had gotten to the point where he didn't want to decipher it. But for now, for some reason, he felt like he was closer to its true meaning than ever before. He sat in the Mercury and pulled out his cell phone and the piece of paper Big F had given him the night before. He checked his watch. It was right at the time the paper said to call. He punched in the numbers and the phone was immediately answered. He was given a set of instructions and then the line went dead. At least they were an efficient bunch. Well, he was going to have a busy night. As he drove off, he paraphrased the immortal words of Tok. Webb London to the rest of the human race. Nobody has control. Chapter 30. Webb drove to Romano's house and picked him up. Angie was standing in the doorway when Romano came out with his bags, and she didn't look very happy. At least, Webb deduced this when he waved to Angie and got the finger in return for his troubles. Romano loaded 2 sniper rifles, an MP5, a set of Kevlar, and 4 semi-automatic pistols, along with ammo clips for each, into the trunk.
Christ, we're not going after Saddam, Paulie. You do it your way and I'll do it mine. The guy who blew away Chris Miller is still out there, and if he's getting off 1,000-yard shots at yours truly, then I want to be able to shoot the son of a bitch back, capiche?
He turned and waved to Angie.
Bye-bye, sweetie pie.
Angie flipped him the bird, too, before slamming the door behind her.
I take it she's upset, said Webb. I had some leave time. We were supposed to go see your mother in Bayou Country. Slidell, Louisiana, to be exact.
I'm sorry, Paulie.
Romano looked at him and smiled before pulling his Yankees cap over his eyes and settling back in his seat.
I'm not.
They drove to East Winds, where they were met at the gate by a pair of FBI agents. They showed their creds and were allowed in. The Bureau presence was here in its full glory after the attempted murder of Billy Canfield via exploding cell phone. The Bureau's bomb squad van passed them going out, no doubt with every bit of evidence they could scrounge from the debris. Webb felt sure that Bureau agents were interviewing everyone on the farm who might be remotely connected with where that phone might have come from. Webb was also sure Billy Canfield would be less than thrilled with all that activity. Yet at least he had saved the man's life. That had gotten them entry into the farm. He had just finished this thought when a horse and rider came into view. It was a big, glossy thoroughbred with a perfect blending of shimmering muscle, tendon, and bone, all moving in a delicate synchronicity that made it seem more machine than animal. Webb had ridden a few times but had never really gotten into it, and yet he had to admit the sight was really something to behold. The rider was dressed in brown riding breeches, high, polished black boots, and a light blue cotton sweater. The hands were gloved. The black riding helmet failed to fully cover the long blonde hair. He rolled his window down as the woman rode the horse over to the car.
I'm Gwen Canfield. You must be Webb.
I am. This is Paul Romano. Did your husband tell you the arrangement?
Yes. He asked me to show you where you'll be staying, said Gwen.
She took off her helmet, pulled back her blonde hair, and it fell across her shoulders. Webb looked at the horse and said,
She's a beauty.
It's a he.
Sorry, didn't check the equipment. Didn't want to embarrass anybody.
She patted the horse's neck.
Baron doesn't mind, do you? Secure in your masculinity, aren't you?
We should all be so lucky.
Gwen eased a bit back on the small English-style riding saddle, one hand firmly holding on to the double loop of reins, and looked around.
Billy told me what happened in the Rover. I want to thank you for what you did.
Billy probably forgot to.
Just doing my job.
Though he had never met Gwen, other HRT members at the trial in Richmond had described her as high-strung and emotional. This woman was very calm, almost detached in a way. Despite her words of gratitude, her tone was subdued. Maybe she had just used up all the emotions she had back then. Webb had seen pictures of Gwen Canfield taken by the media at the trial. Unlike her husband, Gwen had aged very well. She was, he figured, in her mid to late 30s. Her blonde hair was still long. Her figure was that of a woman 10 years younger, with curves where men enjoyed seeing them, and a bosom that would never fail to draw stares. Her features were lovely, with high cheekbones and full lips. If she had been an actress, the camera would have fallen in love with her. She was also tall and carried herself very erect. The horse rider's posture, Webb assumed.
We're going to the carriage house. It's right down this road.
Gwen turned Baron around, punched the horse in the sides with her boots, gave a loud call that sounded indecipherable to Webb, yet in horse language must have meant gallop like holy hell, because that's exactly what old Baron did. Horse and rider flew down the road. Then Gwen leaned forward, actually blending in with the horse's torso, as Baron lifted off the ground, clearing the 3-foot slanted jump-in fence line, a breach in the fence designed to allow horse and rider to pass through, landing in one of the paddocks and galloping on without missing a step or a hoof. Webb honked his horn in applause, and Gwen waved without looking back. The carriage house, as it turned out, was the place with the big Palladian windows and patinaed weather vane Webb had seen earlier. Gwen dismounted from Baron and tethered him to a post. As they were unloading their stuff from the car, Webb gave Romano a sign not to unpack his weapons in front of the woman.
Webb looked at the location of the carriage house and its relation to the main house, which he could barely see down the long tree-lined road. He turned to Gwen.
I don't mean to sound ungrateful, but would it be possible for us to stay in the main house? If anything goes down, it might take us a little too long to get to you.
Billy said the carriage house. If you have a problem with that, you'll have to take it up with him.
Well, I guess I will, Webb told himself. To her, he said, I'm sorry about all this, Mrs. Canfield. You shouldn't have to go through this again.
I never assume the world is fair anymore.
She looked at him closely.
I'm sorry, Billy said that we know you, but I don't remember from where.
I was part of the hostage rescue team that was at the school that day.
She looked down for a moment.
I see. And now that man is loose again. The one who killed David.
Unfortunately, yes, but hopefully not for long.
He should have been put to death.
I'm not arguing with you, Mrs. Canfield.
Just make it, Gwen. We're not too formal out here.
Okay, Gwen. And you can make it Webb and Polly. But we're here to make sure that you and your husband are safe.
She glanced at him.
I haven't felt safe in years, Webb.
I don't think things are going to change now.
She led them inside. The ground floor of the carriage house was filled with restored antique cars. Webb looked at car-happy Romano and thought his partner was going to have a coronary. Gwen explained,
Billy collects them. His little private car museum, I guess.
Jeez, exclaimed Romano. That's a right-hand drive Stutz Bearcat.
He walked around the space in wonder, like a boy at the Baseball Hall of Fame.
And that's a 1939 Lincoln LeBaron. Only 9 of them were ever made. And oh my God.
He rushed over to the far corner of the room and stopped dead.
Webb, this is a 1936 Duesenberg SSJ Speedster.
He looked at Gwen.
Am I wrong, or were there only 2 of these ever built? One for Clark Gable and the other for Gary Cooper. Please tell me I'm not wrong.
Gwen nodded.
You know your cars. That's Coop's.
Romano looked to Webb like he was going to faint.
This is beautiful, said Romano.
He turned to the woman.
I want you to know, Gwen, that I am truly honored to be under the same roof with these legendary machines.
Webb thought he was going to be sick to his stomach. Gwen looked at Webb and shook her head, a tiny smile clutching at the corners of her mouth.
Men and their toys. Do you have any toys, Webb?
Not really. Didn't have any as a kid, either.
She gave him a penetrating stare and then said,
Upstairs are 2 bedrooms, each with its own bath and a fully stocked kitchen and living area. This used to be the estate's carriage house back in colonial times. It's a very historical property. In the 1940s, the owner set it up as the firehouse. Billy reconfigured it as guest quarters when he bought the place. Although with 20 bedrooms in the main house, I always thought a guest house was a bit superfluous.
20 bedrooms, said Romano.
I know, said Gwen. I grew up on a farm outside of Louisville. We had 2 bedrooms for 7 people.
Billy didn't come from money either, that I remember, said Webb.
Trucking is not an easy business, but he did it.
He was complaining that this farm is sucking every cent of his down the drain, commented Romano. But those cars don't come cheap.
Gwen really smiled for the first time, and Webb felt himself smiling at her.
You'll soon learn that Billy Canfield likes to complain about everything, but especially about money. I'm sure he told you we sank every cent we had into this place, and we did. But what he probably didn't tell you is that the first colt we ever sold won the Kentucky Derby and was 3rd in the Preakness.
What was that horse's name?
King David, Gwen answered quietly. Now, we didn't get any of that purse, of course, but it put us on the map,
and we have the broodmare here that had the king. The stallion that we had her studded with wasn't all that great, which means that our mare's bloodlines got a lot of the credit for the king's prowess.
Seems sort of right, though, considering the female does all the real work, said Webb.
Gwen shot him a glance. I like your way of thinking. So, with the king to our credit, everybody in this country who knows anything about horse racing knows about east winds, and our horses generally fetch a nice premium. Now, we do have some race winners here, and the stud fees are impressive. On top of that, we've got a good crop of yearlings the past 2 years, and we run a tight ship. Don't get me wrong, it is amazingly expensive to run a breeding farm. But as much as Billy complains, I think we'll be okay.
That's good to know, said Webb. I guess you came up here soon after the trial.
She said curtly, If you need anything, just call the house and we'll take care of it. The number's on the wall next to the phone upstairs.
She left before they could even thank her. They went upstairs and looked around. The furnishings were all antique, the appointments refined and elegant, and Webb was sure that Gwen Canfield's touches had been felt heavily here. Billy Canfield just didn't seem the interior decorator type.
Man, this is some place, said Romano.
Yeah, some place that's a long way from the people we're supposed to be protecting, and that I don't like.
So call Bates and have him call Canfield and they can yell at each other. We're just the foot soldiers. We do what we're told.
So what do you make of Gwen Canfield?
Seems nice enough. She's a real looker, too. A lady. Canfield's a lucky guy.
Don't get any ideas, Paulie.
Yeah, like Angie would let me live to enjoy it.
Unpack your stuff and let's make rounds. I want to hook up with Canfield. If we're going to protect him, we need to at least be near the guy. And we're probably going to have to go in shifts, Paulie, so we'll alternate sleep.
Hey, just like the good old sniper days.
Yeah, just like the good old sniper days, except you snore like a damn freight train.
Not anymore. Angie had me fixed.
How'd she do that?
I really don't want to get into it, Webb.
They went outside and immediately ran into Percy Bates.
Any luck on the bomb? Asked Webb.
It was a pretty sophisticated device, from what the text told me. We're talking to everybody who might know something, but so far, nothing. But that phone didn't get in there by itself.
So, maybe we have an inside job. A Free Society member on the premises, maybe, added Webb.
Bates nodded, and he looked very worried. They recruit people from areas just like this. Rural white guys who like guns and land and the old ways and have a big chip on their shoulder because they see the world changing fast and they're no longer on top of it.
Anything happening with the freeze in Southern Virginia?
We've got people watching them, but nothing so far. Now, they might just be lying low after all this activity. That would be the smart thing to do. And they're not dumb. They have to know they're suspected in this and that we're watching. All we need is one link, and we can go after them.
Where's Canfield? I sort of like to keep track of the man I'm supposed to be protecting.
Bates said, and Gwen, too. She received the same death threats that her husband did. Webb thought about this.
Well, Paulie and I can split up, but it'd be nice to have more men on this. East Winds looks to be a pretty big place.
2,000 acres and 68 buildings, actually. I talked to Canfield about that, and he said if I wanted to bring more guys out here, he'd see me in court and then see me in hell. And I'm taking the guy at face value. It's up to you two, but listen, Webb, we're not going to be very far away.
I'm counting on that, Purse.
Oh, and Webb.
Yeah?
Thanks for saving my life.
They found Billy Canfield down at the equestrian center examining the foreleg of a stallion while Nemo Strait and two young men dressed in riding clothes looked on. Canfield said to one of the young men,
Better call the vet. Might only be a sprain, but maybe a fracture. Hope to hell it's not.
As the man walked off, Canfield called after him. And tell that damn farrier that unless he comes up with a better shoe, I'm changing shops. We got some stock with soft hooves, and the glue-ons are pretty damn good for that, and he doesn't even carry 'em.
Yes, sir.
Canfield patted the horse's flank, wiped off his hands, and walked over to the HRT man.
Farrier? Asked Romano.
The horseshoer man, answered Canfield. A glorified blacksmith. In the old days, horse farms would keep one on full time. Now they come around once a week in their truck with a forge in the bed and their anvil and hammer and pre-stamped shoes and do their work. They're not cheap, but who'd want to do that kind of work? It's hard, hot, and dangerous, what with crazy horses trying to kick your brains out.
What are those gluons you mentioned? Webb wanted to know.
Straight answered.
Sometimes a horse's hoof walls get too thin for the nails and they break up, especially horses imported from Europe. Because of the climate and soil differences, their hooves get brittle. A soft shoe doesn't require any nails. It's like a little bag over the hooves. It lasts a couple of months if done right. And the gluons are just what they sound like. Shoes glued on, no nails.
Sound like a lot to learn about this business.
Well, I've always been a quick learner, said Billy with a glance at Strait. Next, he stared over at Bates. You guys done talking to my boys? I've got a farm to run. We'll be out of here pretty soon.
Canfield looked at Webb, then pointed at Bates.
He told me about the phone killings and all, but that was still pretty quick thinking on your part.
I'm a fast learner, too, said Webb. Canfield studied him curiously.
Well, what's the next thing you'd like to learn about?
East winds. I'd like to go over every inch of it.
Have to get Gwen to do that. I've got things requiring my attention.
Webb looked at Romano. Polly here will go with you.
Canfield looked like he was going to erupt, but then seemed to pull it back in. All right. He looked at Romano. Paul, how are you on a horse?
Romano jerked, blinked, and looked at Webb and then at Canfield.
I've never been on one.
Canfield put an arm around the HRT man and smiled.
Well, I hope you're as fast a learner as your partner.
Chapter 31 Gwen was at the equestrian center with Baron when her husband asked her to show Webb around the place. She led Webb to the horse stalls.
The best way to see the farm is on horseback. Do you ride? She asked.
A little. I'm certainly not in your league.
Then I've got just the horse for you.
Boo, Gwen told him, was a trakehner. A German breed, a warm-blooded horse bred to be superior war horses and a cross between a hot-blooded, high-spirited, and temperamental Arabian and a cold-blooded, calm, and hard-working draft. The horse weighed about 1,700 pounds, stood almost 18 hands high, and looked at Webb like he wanted to take a bite out of his skull as they stood next to Boo in the stall.
Boo was a great dressage horse, but now his work is done and he doesn't really like to move all that much. He's gotten fat and happy. We call him Old Grump because that's what he pretty much is. But deep down, he's a sweetheart, and he's very flexible, too. You can ride him English or Western saddle.
Yeah, I'm sure, said Webb as he stared up at the beast. Boo didn't look the least bit happy that Webb was in his personal space.
Gwen put the square saddle pad over the horse's back and next had Webb help her place the heavy Western-style saddle over the pad.
Now, watch while I cinch the saddle. He'll hold his breath and push out his belly.
Webb watched in fascination as the horse did exactly that.
When you think it's tight, he'll let out his breath and it loosens. Then you try and climb on and the saddle slides over his withers. The horse gets a good laugh and the rider gets a few bruises.
Good to know dumb animals are that smart, said Webb.
Gwen showed Webb how to transfer from the halter to the bridle, and how to slip the ladder over Boo's head, seat it correctly, and then buckle it. They led Boo outside and over to a stone mounting block. Webb adjusted the chaps Gwen had given him to prevent the saddle from chafing his legs and to allow Webb to get a better grip, stepped onto the block, and climbed aboard, while Boo just stood there patiently.
"So what do you think?" asked Gwen.
"It's a long way down."
She noted the pistol in his holster.
"Do you have to bring the gun?"
"Yes," Webb said firmly.
They went to the riding ring, and Gwen led horse and rider around the ring. Next, Gwen showed Webb neck reining to brake, turn, and back the horse up, and sounds and leg pressure to make the animal go and stop.
"Boo's been all over the farm, so if you'll let him, he'll go where he's supposed to, nice and easy."
Hired help had brought Baron around while they were working with Boo. Gwen mounted up on her horse.
"Now, Boo is the patriarch of this place, and he and Baron have never ridden together before, so Boo may try and establish his dominance over Baron to show him who's boss."
"Sort of like guys with too much testosterone," opined Webb.
Gwen looked at him in a strange way.
"Boo's a gelding, Webb."
He looked at her blankly, not getting it.
"If he were a man, we'd call him a eunuch."
"Poor Boo."
The two horses seemed to establish a grudging truce, and Webb watched as Gwen slipped a Motorola walkie-talkie radio out of her back pocket and turned it on.
"Just in case there's a problem," she said.
"Smart to keep in communication," said Webb. "I've got my cell phone, too."
"After what happened today with Billy, I'm not sure I'll ever use one again," she said.
Webb looked down at his phone and started having some doubts. They started off, trailed by a golden retriever named Opie, and another compact but strongly built canine Gwen called Tough.
"Straight has a dog running around here, too," she said. "Calls him Old Cuss, and it's an apt description because he's nothing but trouble."
The sky was clear, and as they went up and down the small hills on the property, it seemed to Webb that he could see almost all the way to Charlottesville. Boo was content to follow Baron and kept up a sedate pace that didn't tax Webb. Gwen reined Baron to a halt. Webb eased Boo next to her.
"As I said, East Winds has been around a very long time. The King of England gave Lord Culpeper a land grant consisting of millions of acres in the 1600s. A descendant of Lord Culpeper's gave 1,000 acres of this land grant to his eldest daughter upon a marriage to a man named Adam Rolfe. The central part of the house was started in 1765 and completed in 1781 by Rolfe, who was an expert builder and also a merchant. You've seen the outside of the main house?"
Webb nodded.
"Well, it was constructed in the Georgian style, and the millwork, particularly the dental moldings, are some of the best I've ever seen."
"Georgian, that's what I would have guessed."
Webb was lying. He wouldn't have known a Georgian style if it leapt up and bit him in his dental moldings.
"The estate remained in the Rolfe family until the early 1900s. During that time, it was a true working plantation, and crops were raised here. Tobacco, soybeans, hemp, that sort of thing."
"And slaves to work it, I guess," said Webb, "at least until the end of the Civil War."
"Actually, no. The plantation was close enough to Washington that its owners were Northern sympathizers. In fact, East Winds was part of the Underground Railroad." "In 1910, Gwen continued, "the estate was sold out of the family. It passed through a series of hands until Walter Senek bought it at the end of World War II. He was an inventor and made a huge fortune selling his ideas to the automobile manufacturers. He made East Winds into a small, self-contained town, and at its peak, he had over 300 full-time employees here. There was also a company store, phone exchange, firehouse, those sorts of things."
"Nothing like never having to leave home."
The whole time Gwen was talking, Webb had been surveying the grounds, judging where possible attacks might come from and how best to defend against them. Yet if there was a rat on the inside, that sort of strategy might be futile. A Trojan horse worked as well now as it had thousands of years ago. Gwen nodded. Now there are 68 buildings in total with 27 miles of board fencing, 19 paddocks, 15 full-time employees, and we still farm here, corn mostly, although our main interest is breeding thoroughbreds. Next year we have 22 foals due, and we've got a great crop of yearlings going to sale very soon. It's all very exciting.
They rode on and soon came to a high-banked water crossing, where Gwen instructed Webb on how to let the horse choose its own footing when going down into the mud. She had Webb lean back very far, so that his head was almost resting on Boo's rump when the horse was going down the bank. Then she had Webb meld his body into the horse's neck and grasp Boo's mane when the horse was heading up the bank on the other side. Webb successfully navigated the stream and earned high praise from Gwen. They passed an old stone and wood building that Gwen told him was an old Civil War-era hospital that they were thinking of turning into a museum.
"We've rehabbed it, put in central air and heat. It's got a kitchen, bedroom, so the curator could live in there," Gwen told him. "An operating table and surgical instruments from the time period are there as well."
"From what I know of that, a Civil War soldier would have taken a mini-ball any day over a trip to the hospital."
They rode by a 200-year-old bank barn, so named because it was two stories and built on such a steep grade that it had two entrances on separate levels. There was also a riding ring where horse and rider practiced their dressage. Dressage, Gwen explained, consisted of specialized steps and movements of a horse and rider, akin to a figure skater's routine. They passed a tall wooden tower with a stone foundation that Gwen told him had been used for both observation of wildfires and also for the horse races that had been held here a century ago. Webb studied the place and the surrounding countryside. As a former sniper, constantly on the lookout for the best ground, Webb concluded that the tower would definitely be a good observation post, yet he didn't have the manpower to utilize it properly. They rode past a two-story frame building that Gwen identified as the farm manager's house.
"Nemo Strait seems to do a good job for you."
"He's experienced and knows what he's doing, and he brought a full hand-picked crew with him, so that was a plus," Gwen said, with what Webb perceived as little interest.
They examined entry and exit points in the rear grounds, and Webb made mental notes of each. Once, a deer broke clear of the tree line, and Opie and Tuff took off after it. Neither horse reacted to this clamor, although Webb was so startled by the deer flashing in front of him that he had almost fallen off Boo. Next, she led him into a little tree-shaded glen. Webb could hear water running nearby, and he was not prepared, as they rounded a short curve, to see a small open building, painted white and with a cedar-shake roof that looked like a gazebo until Webb saw the cross on top and the small altar inside, with a kneeling pad and a small statue of Jesus on the cross. He looked over at Gwen for an explanation. She was staring at the small temple as though in a trance, and then she glanced over at him.
"This is my chapel, I guess you'd call it. I'm Catholic. My father was a Eucharistic minister, and two of my uncles are priests. Religion runs pretty deep in my life."
"So you had this built?"
"Yes, for my son. I come out here and pray for him just about every day, rain or cold. Do you mind?"
"Please."
"Are you a religious person?"
"In my own way, I guess," Webb answered vaguely.
"I used to be a lot more than I am now, actually. I've tried to understand why what happened could happen to someone so innocent. I've never been able to find an answer."
She dismounted and went inside the chapel, crossed herself,
took out her rosary from her pocket and then knelt down and started to pray while Webb watched her in silence. After a few minutes, she rose and rejoined him. They rode on and finally came to a large building that had clearly been abandoned for some time.
"The old monkey house," said Gwen. "Senek built it and kept all sorts of chimps, baboons, even gorillas there. Why, I don't know. Legend has it that when some of the animals would escape from their cages, they'd be chased through the trees by beer-drinking local yokels with shotguns who didn't want the monkeys around anyway. For that reason, they called the forest around here the monkey jungle. The thought of those poor animals being gunned down by a pack of drunken morons makes me sick."
They dismounted and went into the building. Webb could see through the roof where large holes had been worn in by time and the elements. The old cages, rusted and broken, were still lined up against the walls, and there were trenches, presumably for catching animal waste and other disgusting things. Trash and old broken machinery littered the concrete floor, along with tree branches and rotted leaves. Tree roots clung to the outside walls, and there was what looked to be a loading dock. Webb tried to imagine what an inventor of auto accessories would want with a pack of monkeys. None of his theories were pleasant ones. All Webb could think of was animals strapped to gurneys, electrical lines capturing the power of lightning bolts, and old man Senek in surgical garb ready to do his dirty work on the terrified simians. The place had a distinct feeling of melancholy, of hopelessness, of death even, and Webb was glad to leave it.